This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We bring you the latest true crime updates from Odyssey stations across the nation. This week, we're going to discuss a new study that suggests grunge rock icon Kurt Cobain didn't die by suicide, but that he was murdered. Before we get to the Cobain case, we'll also listen in on an interview with Leavenworth County Attorney Todd Thompson from Kansas. He spoke to Odyssey about a heartbreaking case where a mother was found guilty of manslaughter in the death of her 25-day-old baby. And to start, we have some updates on two high-profile cases, the Nick Reiner and Nancy Guthrie cases. And we have a dispatch about a new murder investigation underway in the Bay Area. Since late last year, we've been tracking the case of Nick Reiner, who has been accused of killing his parents, beloved Hollywood power couple Rob and Michelle Reiner. The 32-year-old initially hired attorney Alan Jackson, famous for representing Kevin Spacey and Harvey Weinstein. But then Jackson dropped out of the case. The attorney has since said that he doesn't believe Nick is guilty. Now Nick Reiner is being represented by a public defender. Here's the latest on his case, reported by Odyssey station KNX News in Los Angeles on Monday, February 23rd.
He was in court briefly, Nick Reiner. The district attorney made it clear that the death penalty is still on the table in this case. Our John Baird was in the courtroom for us, and he joins us now live from outside the criminal courthouse in downtown L.A. John.
It's quite a scene here with a big crowd of media in the plaza outside the building, and the courtroom was filled with members of the media covering the hearing. Again, it was over in like 3 minutes or so. You could barely catch a glimpse of Nick Reiner in the holding area up in front to the right behind the glass in Department 30. Now, through his public defender, Nick Reiner entered a not guilty plea in the deaths of his parents, Rob and Michelle Reiner. D.A. Nathan Hochman says they will be mulling over the decision to seek the death penalty.
We take the process in which we determine whether or not the death penalty should be sought extremely seriously, and it goes through a very rigorous process. We will be looking at all aggravating and mitigating circumstances, and we have invited defense counsel to present to us both in writing and orally in a meeting any arguments that they would like to make in consideration for our going forward or not going forward with the death penalty.
Now we'll head to Odyssey station WBEN in Buffalo, New York, for the latest developments in the Nancy Guthrie case. In early February, the 84-year-old mother of Today Show host Savannah Guthrie went missing. For weeks, investigators have been poring over security footage, testing for DNA evidence, and more in an effort to find Nancy.
There are new questions arising about footage of Nancy Guthrie's alleged captors. Matt Finn has more from Tucson.
Multiple news outlets are citing a single source or multiple sources who say that original Nest camera video on Nancy's doorstep, which was released by the FBI, might show the same masked figure, but on two different days, specifically pointing to one image of the suspect without the backpack as possibly an earlier date than the actual abduction on February 1st. But the Pima County Sheriff's Department calls it speculation, writing, "We are aware that doorbell images released earlier in the investigation depict a suspect in different stages of attire, including with and without a backpack. There is no date or timestamp associated with these images. Therefore, any suggestion that the photographs were taken on different days is purely speculative."
Officials have yet to name a person of interest in this case nearly a month after Guthrie's disappearance.
Savannah Guthrie took to Instagram Friday, as she has multiple times since her mother went missing, to plead for her return. Guthrie's family has offered an award up to $1 million. And now to the Bay Area, where a movie theater parking lot became the scene of a grisly tragedy this week, according to Odyssey station KCBS Radio's report from Wednesday, February 25th.
Authorities are currently investigating a deadly shooting that took place this morning in West San Jose. KCBS's Ken Duffy was at the scene.
Investigators are still combing through part of the parking lot here at the El Paseo de Saratoga shopping mall, where a blue tent was set up near the outside of a movie theater. Police say the two victims were found with single gunshot wounds and died on scene. Somebody initially called police about it just before noon.
The male and the female both knew each other, and there is no ongoing threat to public safety.
That's San Jose Police Department spokesman Sergeant Jorge Garibay.
I don't have a whole lot of information in terms of how this occurred. However, I can tell you that both the adult male and the adult female were known to each other, and that there is currently no ongoing threat to public safety.
Garibay says they're still talking to any witnesses and couldn't say much about the possible person or persons who carried this out.
These things don't typically happen in an intersection like this in the broad daylight. There is going to be hopefully a lot of witnesses, and we are asking for the public's assistance. If they may have saw something and they left the scene, to please contact the San Jose Police Department.
In Kansas, 43-year-old Megan Forbes was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter this week. Her story serves as a cautionary tale for many parents. She was co-sleeping with her infant after a night of drinking in 2022. According to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, 46% of parents in the U.S. say they do some sort of co-sleeping with their children through age 18. Leavenworth County Attorney Todd Thompson joined the Dana and Park Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City this week to discuss the Forbes case.
These cases are heartbreaking, and I always feel for the first responders and the jurors and certainly the family of the infant. What was it about this case that led you to bring the charges initially? Just in the first place, what was it?
Well, you know, we're seeing that and kind of the across the board, doctors, medical professionals, everyone is teaching people that co-sleeping is bad, that mothers, parents should be putting their babies in cribs, you know, firm, no stuffies, no pillows, no blankets, you know, next to them. And we see that the CDC has said that 70% of deaths that they find for sudden infant death syndrome have been when they found that a baby was lying next to an adult. They also said about 70% of deaths that they're finding are when a bed is actually soft, or, you know, it's in a bed instead of in a crib. And that's kind of the standard of care that parents are supposed to be looking at, or we hope that parents are looking at when they, you know, when they're caring for an infant, someone under at least under 6 months to under a year. And so with that, just that standard of care, that is, you know, what we think is a reasonable parent should be looking at. But there is a gross deviation in this case, which is the recklessness of it, of the involuntary manslaughter. And that was because there was what we showed in evidence was there was a lot of alcohol that was consumed by Ms. Forbes prior to placing the child next to her and then the baby being found to asphyxiated on October 16th, 2022.
Todd, let me ask, if the mom had co-slept with her child but was sober, would you have charged her?
No, I don't think that would rise to the gross deviation. What we've seen for cases around the nation, and what we still see is that a lot of people, and even in the jury when we were questioning them, our jury pool, a lot of people do co-sleep. I think a lot of people still have the belief that co-sleeping enhances a bond between the adult, the parent, and the child, and improves the sleep for the child, and promotes like an emotional security. What we see is that the parents think like, oh, the baby's going to sleep better and is better to have next to them. And we understand that that's still kind of the thought process, but it's, and a lot of people still think it's not going to happen to me, but it's that risk that actually happens when they sleep next to their baby. And we do see that. We saw a rise in it. What caused us to charge this was the reckless nature of the amount of alcohol before placing the child there. We've heard from plenty of parents who said, I'm a light sleeper. I would wake up. I would know if I would roll over. And we know that parents are so tired throughout the first year of having an infant. But there was that extra, that recklessness, that gross deviation of alcohol being applied to it. And we knew that earlier that day, she actually had taken some medication that was supposed to work with alcohol either. And there was alleged that there was maybe some marijuana in the house on top of that. But those extra factors is what, the extraneous factors is what caused us to charge this case.
I was a little surprised at her age, Todd. Were there other children in the home at the time, or was that the only child?
There were other children at the home.
Okay. I only ask because, you know, 43 is on the upper end of mother. And if you had said to me this happened and it was a 19-year-old mother, I think I would have maybe expected that. It was a little surprising to me that she was 43.
Yes, but there was no other children in the bed. It was just it was just that child.
Now, Dad had also been at the party. He was also in the bed. He had also been drinking, according to this story from Channel 9, but he is uncharged, correct?
That is correct. The dad was actually not next to the child, and it was actually evidence had shown that the dad mother had a conversation, and the mother was going to be responsible for the child that night.
Got it. And her sentencing is scheduled, Todd, for March 27th. What do the guidelines look in a case like this?
So an involuntary manslaughter with no criminal history is what's called a border box case. So it's a presumptive prison. But if there's enough that the judge would believe that there's a reason not to put them in prison, they could look at probation. Depending on the criminal history, they could look up to a couple years in prison.
What are you going to recommend?
I can't discuss that at this time because that's still pending. These deaths are preventable deaths, and there is a standard of care that every parent has with a child, and we would hope that this raises awareness of, you know, the concerns of even co-sleeping, but much less any type of impairment when you're caring for a child. It increases that risk.
So there's some forensic scientists have now come to the conclusion that Kurt Cobain did not commit suicide, that he was actually murdered.
Kurt Cobain, the frontman of grunge rock band Nirvana, is known as the voice of his generation. Even after his death in 1994 at age 27, Cobain has continued to have an impact. I know I played my Nirvana CDs over and over again on the way to middle school back in 2004, and I was fascinated with his journals, which were published as a hardcover book in 2002. I also remember another book called Who Killed Kurt Cobain. It was released in 1998, and it was written by Ian Halperin and Max Wallace. Cobain's death was ruled a suicide. He was found at his Seattle, Washington home with a shotgun wound to the head and a large amount of heroin in his body in April 1994.
And I'll never forget the pictures that they showed. There was a picture of it was like a pane glass window upstairs in his Seattle home. And you could see Kurt Cobain's leg. And he was wearing Converse.
But there were always rumors. Rumors that it wasn't a suicide, that something else had happened.
And there are people who believe that. They believe that idea that Kurt Cobain didn't commit suicide and that Courtney Love really wanted him dead. That's one theory, that Courtney Love wanted to kill him.
That's Scoot out of Odyssey Station WWL in New Orleans. He covered the new development in this decades-old case, a study published in the International Journal of Forensic Sciences Open Access Journal. According to the study authors, Cobain was a homicide victim. Experts who conducted the study include Brian Burnett, who runs a private forensic laboratory in San Diego, Aaron Brudenell, a firearms consultant, James Green, a handwriting examiner, and several Italian forensic scientists who contributed additional analysis. Mark Larson, a former longtime chief of the criminal division at the King County Prosecutor's Office in Washington, also supported this study, according to military.com. He believes the Cobain case was, quote, underinvestigated. Michelle Wilkins, the Canadian blogger and amateur sleuth who led the research team, said her interest in Cobain's death began when she watched the 1998 documentary Kurt and Courtney by filmmaker Nick Broomfield. That's according to military.com's report. Scoot also remembers that film.
I did some research into this, and this was after I watched the documentary Kurt and Courtney in 1999. I became open to the idea that Kurt Cobain's death was not suicide and that maybe he was murdered. And here are a few credible reasons to support the idea that Kurt Cobain was murdered. And this is stuff that I came up with after I watched Kurt and Courtney. There were discrepancies in the police reports, and this drew a lot of suspicion. There were no distinguishable fingerprints on the shotgun, and Kurt Cobain was not wearing gloves. Tom Grant was a private investigator hired by Courtney Love to find Kurt Cobain after he disappeared from a rehabilitation center. The more he investigated Kurt's death, the more he believed that Kurt was murdered. One of the strong points that Grant mentioned was the amount of heroin found in Kurt's body after his death. It would have made it physically impossible. Well, it would have been very difficult for him to physically pull the trigger of the shotgun. He was so loaded on heroin, it would have been hard for him to actually pull the trigger. Grant came to believe that Courtney killed her husband, and Grant was hired by Courtney Love to look into this. So Grant theorized that Courtney mixed a large quantity of pain meds with champagne in Rome in March of 1994 to set up the scenario that her husband was suicidal.
Scoot is referring to an incident that occurred in March 1994, around a month before Cobain's death. According to the Los Angeles Times, Cobain was rushed to a hospital in Rome, Italy. It said he had overdosed on a mixture of champagne and painkillers in a hotel room that he had been in with Love and their daughter.
Why would Courtney want Kurt dead? In a conversation with Kurt's attorney, Rosemary Carroll, about a week after Kurt's body was discovered, Carroll said that Kurt asked her to draw up a new will, cutting Courtney out of everything. At the time of his death, Kurt Cobain was believed to have a net worth of $150 million. People close to Kurt knew that he was planning to divorce Courtney. It's obvious they were estranged at the time of his death because his body was not discovered until days later. And the day before Kurt's body was discovered, Courtney was arrested on drug and theft charges while his body lay dead at their home. Courtney had apparently been disgusted with Kurt when he turned down the opportunity to be the headliner of the 1994 Lollapalooza Festival tour, which would have brought in close to $10 million. Before his death, it was reported that Courtney was searching for a high-profile divorce attorney who could void the prenuptial agreement she signed before their marriage, which kept the money separate. The leader of the band, The Mentors, Eldon Hoke, no relation to Ian Hoke, said that Courtney offered him $50 million to kill Kurt. But there was no concrete evidence to support the claim. Even Courtney's father, Hank Harrison, has said that his daughter had a clever motive to kill Kurt. And then there are the discrepancies over the suicide note left in a flower pot. A practice note was discovered in Courtney's purse that was similar to the last part of Kurt's suicide note. It read, "I don't have the passion anymore, and so remember, it's better to burn out than to fade away." Those were the lyrics from Neil Young's song, "My, My, Hey, Hey, Out of the Blue." The note went on to ask Courtney to keep going for the sake of their daughter, Frances Bean. And it concluded with, "I love you, I love you, I love you." Would Kurt have written those words in all caps if he was planning to divorce Courtney and shut her out of his will? We don't know.
The team behind the new study argued that Cobain couldn't have operated the shotgun in the manner described by police. They also believed that the concentration of heroin in Cobain's blood would have rendered him unconscious. They also found it suspicious that the left-handed Cobain had what appeared to be signs of an injection on his left forearm. Furthermore, the team argued that blood spatter patterns on Cobain's body indicate that it might have been repositioned after his death.
There are definitely legitimate questions surrounding his death and that support the idea that he did not commit suicide. However, there is no corroborating evidence to prove that it was not suicide. Kurt Cobain was a complicated, mysterious person. He was as complicated and mysterious as his music was. And he really did help define the genre of grunge music.
The Seattle Police Department considers the Cobain case closed, according to the Seattle Examiner. It said that Wilkins and her team actually presented their findings to the department last November. Assistant Chief Nicole Powell told them in January that the department stands by the findings of the original investigation from the 1990s, as well as a 2014 review of the case.
And the suicide and depression that ran in Kurt Cobain's family is something that is, you know, part of the equation. He had chronic stomach pain. He suffered with it. He had mental health issues that he dealt with on a daily basis.
Regardless of the way Cobain died, his legacy lives on in his work. He might have been the voice of Gen X, but his music has continued to resonate with younger generations. Cobain is now also considered a rock icon alongside other prominent figures, even though he was controversial in the 90s. Here's Scoot to explain.
Kurt Cobain was one of many artists who died at the age of 27. There's the 27 Club that is often talked about. And when the news first broke that Nirvana singer Kurt Cobain had committed suicide, there was a collective reaction from the boomer generation, and it was basically, he deserved it. Now, not everybody in the boomer administration, the boomer generation thought that, but a lot did. I mean, I heard that. I heard that from listeners. When he committed suicide, I heard people, he deserved it. They called into the show. I mean, this was part of what I dealt with. And I just thought it was really sad that boomers had obviously forgotten about Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and Jim Morrison, all of whom died within 10 months of each other, and their deaths were related to drug use and alcohol use, and they were all 27 years old. Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones also died at the age of 27. So it seems like 27 is kind of a tipping point in the lives of a lot of very creative people. And we could talk about that another time, why the age of 27 is a tipping point. But my generation, the boomer generation, it just really passed off Kurt Cobain as nothing because they didn't get his music. They didn't get him. And so boomers were now the establishment when Kurt Cobain killed himself. And, you know, there were a lot of people who thought, well, you know what? He deserved it. Well, what about Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and Jim Morrison? Did they deserve it? Well, no, that was different. No, it's not different. And so this is why I often refer to myself as a hostile witness to the baby boomer generation. It struck me that the most tragic thing about Kurt Cobain's death was that a young generation would be robbed of the opportunity to watch him age with them and to give his generation the same comfort that boomers have when they see Paul McCartney, Mick Jagger, Rod Stewart, and many others still performing today, some of them in their 80s. Kurt Cobain's audience has evolved. I'd like to see how Kurt himself would have evolved and how he would be today. If you believed Kurt Cobain committed suicide, it's sad to think that his exploding popularity was exactly what he and his music were rebelling against. And maybe Kurt saw himself as the ultimate artist that was killed by his own popularity.
Anyone out there struggling with mental health issues can get help by calling or texting the 24/7 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to KNX News in Los Angeles, WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo, KCBS Radio in the Bay Area, The Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, and Scoot out of WWL in New Orleans. You can find these shows on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can find these true crime roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.